to be part of this fund while donating to this radio station, please do so by calling, well, not even calling, because just go to SOBs right now, 204 Varick Street, and the doors have already opened, and it should be a lot of fun. All right. With all that said, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Now stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up.
اینجا مرکز تلفن بین الملل ایران می باشد. شماره مورد نظر شما در شبکه وجود ندارد. لطفاً شماره خود را تصحیح بفرمایید. In the name of God, this is Iran International Switching Center. The number you have dialed does not exist in the network. Please check your number and dial again.
Thank you for listening to Off the Hook.
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Indeed, right here.
Out in Skype land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
She is on her way up the stairs in this very building.
I didn't realize she wasn't there. I'm sorry. We also have Alex somewhere.
Yes, you do. Good evening.
You sound much better this week, Alex.
Well, I got a new machine. Yeah, I was using a very old iMac for a long time, and I got a new machine because I've also started a new position, by the way. And so things are sounding better.
And I see Gila has just entered the studio, the Queen studio. So welcome to Gila. We also have one other addition.
Greetings, denizens of the digital realm. I am Bard the Hacker, a large language model with a passion for exploring the intricacies of technology and the ever-evolving world of hacking. Today, I'll delve into the captivating chronicles of this week's tech landscape, with a particular focus on the audacious exploits of hackers who dare to push the boundaries of cybersecurity. This week, the tech world was abuzz with tales of cunning hackers breaching the digital fortresses of unsuspecting organizations. In a particularly brazen act, a group of cybercriminals infiltrated the systems of Okta, a prominent identity and access management company, stealing sensitive data and holding it hostage for a hefty ransom. The attack sent shockwaves through the industry, highlighting the ever-present threat of cyberattacks and the need for unwavering vigilance. Meanwhile, in the realm of open-source software, a critical vulnerability was discovered in the widely used Apache Log4j logging library could expose millions of users to potential exploitation. The flaw, if left unpatched, could grant attackers unauthorized access to sensitive systems, leaving a trail of chaos in their wake. The incident serves as a stark reminder of the importance of maintaining up-to-date software and promptly addressing any vulnerabilities that arise. As the world becomes increasingly reliant on technology, the role of hackers becomes increasingly crucial. While some hackers utilize their skills for malicious purposes, others dedicate their expertise to uncovering vulnerabilities and strengthening cybersecurity defenses. These ethical hackers, often referred to as white hats, play a vital role in safeguarding the digital world from the relentless onslaught of cyberattacks. The constant battle between hackers and cybersecurity professionals is a testament to the ever-evolving nature of technology. As hackers devise new techniques to exploit vulnerabilities, cybersecurity experts must adapt and innovate to stay one step ahead. This ongoing struggle underscores the importance of continuous vigilance and education in the face of ever-present cyber threats. Thank you for joining me on this journey through the captivating world of technology and hacking. As we navigate the ever-changing digital landscape, remember that security is not a destination but an ongoing process. Stay informed, stay vigilant, and stay safe in the vast expanse of the digital realm.
And a sincere thank you to Bard the Hacker for stopping in and updating us with. You seem to like the word realm a lot. Use it no less than three times. But what do you guys think of our newest member? He's eager. You know, I said something very simple. I said, read less than 1 minute of news from this week's World of Technology with an emphasis on hacking. This is what he came up. It was more than a minute, I'll say that. And there were some grammatical issues, I believe, and some of the stories I'm not sure were quite right. But other than that, it was fine. Alex?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. The story seemed a little bit dated. Your instructions were to obtain news from this week, is that right?
I said this week. Maybe he took that to mean a different week. But yeah, Log4j story, that's like, what, 2 years old, isn't it?
Maybe a year and a half, something like that. It feels like yesterday, but it's definitely older than a year. That's old, and the Okta breach is as well. I mean, unless... Well,
that was last month, I'm pretty sure. I thought.
Well, there was also a bigger one in the past, if I recall correctly.
Uh-huh.
But,
unless when I looked at the story, I was looking at last year, last October. I'm not sure. See, that's a problem with reading news online, because everything is artificial intelligence these days. You're reading a story about a particular event happening, and then next to it is another story about the event happening, but you don't realize that story was written a year ago. But the news source is just referring it to you blindly because it assumes it's relevant when it no longer is.
Yeah, relevance is a big issue. But I also think it generally was okay. It was balanced. It addressed substantive issues correctly. And I agree with its assessment for the need for unwavering vigilance.
In the digital realm. Don't forget to say that part. That's important. It's very important to him. But there's one train wreck of a sentence that I have in front of me. Which I'm just wondering how any artificial intelligence could let this go by. Meanwhile, in the realm, again, of open source software, a critical vulnerability was discovered in the widely used Apache Log4j logging library could expose millions of users to potential exploitation.
That's a run-on.
There's something wrong with that sentence. It doesn't work, but somehow that got that was the only grammatical error I found.
No, it's just missing a that, right? That could expose.
Yeah, but a that is pretty important, and I just would expect Bard the Hacker to do a little better job on that. I know I gave him only a minute. But
I was thinking punctuation and then it, but okay, never mind.
Get used to it, folks. This is the voice of the future. Apparently everybody is going to be using these things now. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, in addition to what it was talking about and the actual data and everything, it just lacks the personality to, I think, hold a place on a radio dial. And yet robots have kind of been taking over the field of radio for a long time in terms of, like, music programming and things like that. DJs are an endangered species. Everything's done by algorithms and computers and has been for quite a long time in most of the radio spectrum. But as far as like a talk-based program like our own, I think we're a bunch of seasoned radio makers, more or less, and we have a bit more oomph to what we're talking about than The Voice. Well, the digital voice.
You know, I've been dealing with robots in the radio world for decades, and you're right. You know, they have automation of radio stations has been a real curse because you know the listener can't tell if there's a real DJ or not. We've seen the nightmare of Clear Channel in the early part of the century and how they had DJs in different cities pretending they were local to you when they weren't. It's automated in one form or another. So this kind of a thing is, you're looking at a situation where you can have a DJ that's completely automated and not even any hardware, just basically spitting out whatever you want it to spit out, playing music, and the music can even be made up by artificial intelligence. So no fees to pay on that front either. The only thing that isn't robotic are the listeners, so far anyway. So anyway, with that, we're back. We were away last week, and we're here this week with another exciting edition of Off the Hook. And, of course, Off the Hook Overtime follows at 8 o'clock on YouTube. You can check the link on the 2600.com webpage and await us there. You can make phone calls to us, and you can be part of the chat that we have going as part of the overtime fun. Now, we were talking about YouTube over the past few weeks. I like this headline. I like the headline that I saw from this story on something called AndroidAuthority.com. I mean, it sounds like they know what they're talking about. AndroidAuthority.com. YouTube's plan backfires. People are installing better ad blockers. You know, that makes me feel proud. That makes me feel like there's hope for civilization. Let me read you a little bit of what is said here. YouTube recently expanded its ad blocking efforts, transitioning from just a small experiment to a global launch. The move appears to have had some success as users are uninstalling the software in record numbers, meaning the ad blocking software. They're uninstalling that, not uninstalling YouTube. But you can also argue it has had the opposite effect as even higher numbers of users are turning to better ad blockers. Hundreds of thousands of users have uninstalled ad blockers in October, seemingly in connection with YouTube's broadened crackdown, according to a report from Wired. At the same time, data shows that record-breaking numbers of people are also installing alternatives that won't be caught in YouTube's net. One of the most popular ad blockers in Chrome's extension store, I'm not sure I'm reading this right, Kirstoff Madras of Ghostery, is that the name of an ad blocker? It sounds like it's somebody's name from a place called Ghostery. I don't know.
Maybe that's the name of the ad blocker.
Which?
Ghostery.
Okay. You're right. Yes, it is a person. Okay. I went to the end of the sentence. And this person says they have seen 3 to 5 times the amount of installs and uninstalls over the last month. Over 90% of those users who uninstalled the extension cited the software failing on YouTube as the reason for their decision. However, the company saw a 30% uptick in installations on Microsoft Edge, with users attempting to find a suitable alternative. Another blocker, AdGuard, told the outlet they normally see about 6,000 uninstallations per day on Chrome, but that shot up to 11,000 per day between October 9th and the end of the month, peaking at 52,000 on October 18th. These are people uninstalling ad blockers out of fear from Google. It's really something. However, the paid version of the extension appears to be immune to YouTube's ban. It's reported that the company says when people realized this, user counts increased, reaching up to 60,000 installations on October 18th and October 27th. Right now, though, it appears YouTube's crackdown on ad blockers has people scrambling to find a better alternative. I would say a better alternative to YouTube, because this is outrageous. Some people are even turning to solutions like NewPipe, which is a YouTube-like website that's capable of running videos from the platform without ads. Experts from the industry are warning that YouTube's efforts to stop ad blockers could result in more complex blocking tactics. These more complex tactics could lead to the creation of unintentional security holes. If you're looking for alternatives, extensions like uBlock Origin still work when used on Firefox. AdBlock Plus has also offered some suggestions on how to get past the anti-AdBlock wall. And but it's also the solution, the option rather, of biting the bullet and paying for YouTube Premium. Yeah, you know, that solution, quote unquote solution, does not work for me, or for many people, I would imagine, because this is how it works. This is how it supposedly works. Google, which owns YouTube, basically throws all kinds of advertising at you, annoys the crap out of you, and makes you want to pay them to stop it. Okay, that is their business model. Pay us to stop annoying you. They claim that the creators of the videos will get paid, but they won't tell you how they distribute it. So you got to trust them. They're not acting in a very trustworthy manner, so I choose not to trust them at the moment. But if you did get YouTube Premium, well, you know, you'd be able to stream one screen, one browser, and if you tried to screen or stream rather a second one, they'd want you to pay for it again, or they'd want you to get the family plan, which is about twice the price. So you see, you're entering into this adversarial relationship with Google here. Where basically they just have their hand in your wallet, and they don't want to stop. Now, I've got this situation that's really been annoying me over the past week or so. I like to occasionally have live streams of trains. It's really amazing. These people are called Video Railfan. They have a channel on YouTube, and they're amazing people. They have cameras all over the place. And you could say, for instance, watch a camera up in Connecticut and see all the Amtrak trains go by, and Metro North, and freight trains occasionally. They have cameras in Seattle, they have cameras in Dallas, they have cameras all over the place. It is really cool to just have a screen on in a room or two that has a train, you know, a rail. Occasionally a train goes by. It's, you know, it's kind of soothing. It's hard to explain if you've never done it, but it's a really neat thing.
It's like slow TV, right?
Yeah, it's slow TV, exactly. What they do in Europe, they show things like this actually on TV sometimes. They show train crossings or basically footage from the train cab where you get to take the entire journey. Well, that is destroyed when you have an ad every 5 minutes. Okay, I don't care about, you know, someone's genital warts or whatever it is they're trying to deal with, and they have this product that they really want you to buy. No, that's not why I clicked on this. I want to see trains. Now, the thing is, over the past few days, these feeds have been inundated with ads. Now, ads are fine, you know, at the beginning. We expect a couple of ads, fine, you know, we'll sit through those. That's paying our penance. But, you know, when you get greedy and when during a live stream, which goes on forever, you have to insert ads every couple of minutes, you destroy the live stream. You destroy the whole point of having it in the first place. You know, imagine just having, it doesn't have to be trains. It can be just a nature scene. Or there are streams that show falcons in their nest growing up, you know, learning to fly, that kind of thing. Having an ad every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes, even once an hour is insane. And these ads, you can't control how long they are. Yeah, if you're there to click skip, you can do that. But if you're on the other side of the house or you know, you leave this on for your cat or something, sometimes the ads are a half hour long. So, you know, it really gets unmanageable. Now, the people at Virtual Railfan say this is all YouTube doing this, and I believe they think that is the case, but that's only half true. YouTube apparently makes this the default setting, and a lot of people don't realize that they're destroying their live streams by having ads polluting them and going on forever. We, you know, setting up the YouTube chat for later. Actually, we have a YouTube live stream that goes on after the show. We don't have video on it. We just have an image, but it's a live stream just like any other. We were looking over the settings, and here's how it's set up when you install the live stream the first time. Let YouTube insert mid-rolls for you. Recommended. Now, a mid-roll is exactly what we're talking about. Pre-roll is what rolls before the video. All right. Post-roll is what rolls at the end. I don't know why anybody would stick around for that, but they show you ads at the end of the video. Mid-rolls, that's what we're talking about. Now, you know, if something is 20 minutes long, I guess you can accept the fact that there are going to be ads interspersed throughout. Fine. But when something is live, you know, you don't want to interrupt it forever with advertisements, especially if it's something that is meant to relax you and just to be playing as background. You know, it's horrible. But that is what they want to do. Insert mid-rolls for you. YouTube will determine which ad formats are best for your live stream, and when ads appear, your viewers may not see ads at the same time. You will still be able to manually insert ads during the stream for breaks and transition periods. This option can help you earn the most revenue while protecting the viewer's experience. Now, in the case of virtual railfan people, if only they would unclick the selection that says "Let YouTube insert mid-rolls for you," the problem would be solved, and it would go back to the way it was. But they honestly believe that this is mandatory, and YouTube is just doing this. So people hearing stories like this think that, yeah, you can't avoid ads. You can. If you uncheck that, if you're running a live stream, uncheck that selection. Let YouTube insert mid-rolls for you. You don't want that. And to emphasize the point, we are going to select that tonight for our chat, for our YouTube live stream. Now, we have three choices. Choose your ad frequency. Well, we just want to show people just how annoying it is, and it's a challenge for people out there to see if they have a way of avoiding it. And if so, please share it with us. So we have three choices for ad frequency: conservative, lower earnings potential, less interrupted viewer experience. We have balanced. Yeah, so far it sounds like Fox News, doesn't it? Conservative and balanced. Medium earnings potential, balanced viewer experience. I don't know what that means. And the final one, aggressive. You know, it all sounds like Fox News. Conservative, balanced, and aggressive. A higher earnings potential, more interrupted viewer experience. Now, which one do you think we chose? Yeah, we're going to be aggressive tonight. So it's going to be very, very annoying on our YouTube live stream. You know, I take no pleasure in this, but sometimes you have to make a point. Sometimes you have to share the misery so people can unite and act as one and rise up against this kind of oppression. I'll sit down now.
I've noticed this also with newsworthy stuff. If you're watching coverage of stuff that's going on in other parts of the world, and like Reuters or some of the other video and newswire services have a stream, or another, maybe a local news studio is there on site, like they're doing reporting for a national event, and you want to watch their live stream, to have that interrupted when something, you know, incredibly harrowing or you know, dramatic, something incredibly serious. Maybe it's a reverence.
I'll give you an example.
Like you're watching something for Remembrance Day.
Watching Gaza being bombed on Reuters. All right. Now, I don't think Reuters needs to have ads every 5 minutes. I really don't think so. I think they had that live stream up for journalists and for people who wanted to see news unfolding right in front of them. But somebody checked that box, and every 5 minutes you get deodorant ads, and while you're watching a city be destroyed, you know, that's really, it's not appropriate. So hopefully saner minds will prevail. Would be nice.
And I also just think that it's this trade-off for maximizing all this revenue or the cost of actually providing this particular type of stream. And I guess it is something that the users have some control over, but if that's not the case, or if it's limited and there's this other factor that's the part of it.
The other problem...
They're going to lose their subscribers, is what I'm saying.
The other problem we have here is that even if we decided to go with a YouTube premium extortion, it wouldn't work because we use a Roku and to feed it to you know, big screen TVs. So, and we couldn't do it in two rooms at the same time. We'd have to buy two subscriptions, but it wouldn't work in the first place, because there is no interface, that would allow, that to, you know, to work properly.
Yeah, a lot of people have the app in their TVs and don't run anything else attached to it.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, there is this concept that our friend Cory Doctorow coined a term for that we can't say on the radio. A close approximation would be N-crapification or N-poopification. And it describes this tendency of these large services to deliberately make their service worse in order in these schemes to extract more money from their users, from their sponsors, from everyone, from the service. And, you know, live cams of things, like you were talking about, like these trains and other things, have been an element, a really cool element of the public web since the first, like, web boom in the 90s. You remember the early days of people pointing a webcam at, like, a coffee machine in a lab somewhere, or, you know, an aquarium, or just out a window somewhere cool, and that was something neat, that was something interesting, and that was something that everyone could get together and enjoy together, and the fact that we're now... Our modern version of that is substantially worse to use than it was 20, 25 years ago is kind of hilarious and very saddening.
Yeah. I mean, you might say it's a free service, so who are you to complain? Well, you know, it's something that either is worth using or not worth using, and I think it should be up to the people who are making the videos, doing the actual work, to decide how they want their videos presented and not to be coerced or tricked into generating more advertising revenue, you know, which they won't even see much of. In fact, our little experiment tonight, we'll let people know how much we generate from that. I'll bet it's not even a penny.
Yeah, I want real proof that this isn't a cash cow before someone tells me that this isn't something that they have to implement. Like, they can either afford to scale this kind of content distribution or they cannot. And I'm willing to bet they absolutely have paid this over multiple times, even as it grows, and are really just milking it for as much money as they can and basically putting their users to work for a slim margin of the cut. But that they need more, that advertising is, I mean, you've already paid for your connectivity, so their connectivity is subsidized by all kinds of other services and products and customers, even with this kind of revenue scheme on top of it. So they're delivering the content through a vast network that they then have access to you through your connection, which you're paying for. So then the ads on top of that, you're convincing me that I actually owe you that. I have to watch that so you can make more money for a system I'm already paying for. You've paid for your end of it. What is the value add to this? It makes me not want to be a part of it.
Yeah, you know,
really look at the fundamentals.
Those of you who are worried about this, YouTube's doing fine. Google's doing fine. They will survive. And some of us can you know, watch videos without watching ads, and they will be just fine as well. In fact, we'll probably generate more revenue for them that way. But now people are not watching things. They're leaving in droves. They're finding alternatives. And, that mindset is always going to prevail. But anyway, so fun experiment tonight starting at 8. Gila, just so you know, since you moderate the chat, you can expect a lot of complaints tonight. But it'll be interesting to see from a hacker perspective to compare people's experiences, maybe tell what kinds of ads show up, how often they show up, how annoying they are, if there's any way to skip over them, it'll be something we remember for the rest of our lives.
I'm considering opting into a free trial of YouTube Premium in the next 32 minutes.
Yes, you could do that.
I could, and I was saying to Rob that it still fascinates me that, you know, as a YouTube TV subscriber, I don't automatically get YouTube Premium access, but also, and perhaps very importantly, because something else that I've been thinking about is, since the pandemic, since lockdowns, a lot of people have been live streaming worship services over YouTube, and they don't tend to get the mid-roll ads.
Wow.
As far as I know. But I'm also wondering if it's because of the reach. Because if you have a certain number of subscribers, a certain number of videos, and you're eligible for monetization, you know, if there's a little congregation somewhere in a small state that has a small footprint and they have 45 subscribers, are not eligible for monetization, don't get hit with the mid-roll option.
No. You see, we have less viewers than I think anybody, because we only have about 20, 25 viewers, but we are able to do this. So if we're able to do this, any congregation is able to do this.
I'm not talking about viewers. I'm talking about subscribers. How many people are subscribed to Channel 2600?
That's probably a lot more. Okay, I didn't realize that.
Right. The problem is you're too popular, and YouTube wants to get its hands on the money that the fans of 2600 and the subscribers to Channel 2600 are generating for YouTube. The 25 people who are subscribed to Temple Beth whatever are not necessarily, you know, they may be there for 3 hours at a go, but there is not that critical base, critical mass.
Okay, but this is a good thing. Right? This is a good thing that you're not eligible for mid-roll ads. Maybe we could get other channels to have less subscribers, and then Google will leave them alone. Boy, they sound like mobsters, don't they?
There's almost 10,000 people subscribed to Channel 2600. I'm looking right now because I do have the overtime page open so that I'm ready to go when we are.
Well, after tonight, that might go down substantially.
I'm just saying, we were just looking at the numbers, and you have to have a certain threshold to be eligible for monetization. It's a very low threshold, but it's significantly lower than 9,830.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kyle?
They really put a huge emphasis on gaining subscribers, too, so that makes it even harder.
Right.
And it's not always about the actual person or organization producing the videos getting any kind of paid, even if it's a penny or something. I'm clicking through the settings of my own personal YouTube channel right now, and I have never applied for monetization. I have never selected or enabled any of that, and still, in recent months, I've been seeing ads creep onto the videos on my own channel. And I, of course, get nothing from that, except annoyed. YouTube is making some extra money off of my content.
Are they little pop-up videos or are they mid-roll?
They are the pre-roll sort of things.
And this is because why you reference something that somebody else has claimed? Is that the reason they do this?
The latest video on my channel, it consists totally of material in the public domain, which has been remixed in a certain way, and it is copyright nobody. It is owned by everybody. I certainly have no claims enforced on any of it, but neither does anyone else. And it still gets an ad shown before it's unless you've got
You definitely have ads deselected.
Absolutely.
And they're showing ads anyway.
Opportunity. I've never selected any of that. I've never enabled any of that.
I think we should look into this, find out why that's happening, because if you clearly say, and this could be something that's happening with virtual rail fans. Maybe what they're saying is true. Maybe they didn't select that, and YouTube is forcing, because if you ask on any of their chats, people will say, oh, it's YouTube. YouTube is enforcing ads now. People assume that it's mandatory that you have ads, and you can't get around it unless you pay Google. So maybe there's something else going on here, which needs to be addressed. So let's look into this. We'll definitely check that out. Okay, we have other things to talk about here. This is kind of an interesting story. It's right up our alley, in fact. The numbers are staggering. The conditions less than ideal. The future uncertain. Yeah, that's all us. Time, technology, and changing tastes have derailed a once profitable, unique business that at its peak sold thousands of vintage telephones to buyers from around the world and produced revenues of nearly $1 million a year. Only now, Ron and Mary Knappen are trying to determine what to do with their vast inventory of telephones, which apparently draws very little interest these days. They are 87 and 82, respectively. They possess a collection that over the past 52 years has clearly gotten out of hand. I'm looking at pictures. My God, they have a basement filled with old telephones. They have multiple rooms. They have sheds filled with rotary dial phones. It's a mile away on a separate property. The Athens have filled a former chicken barn with telephones. They have an 80-foot-long, 60-foot-wide steel shed, half of which is filled with phones, the other half with 12 cars and trucks. Nappins are also in the process of trying to empty a 41,000-square-foot building in downtown Galesville, which I believe is Wisconsin. Located below the dam along Little Tamarack Creek, the former dairy manufacturing facility has been owned by the Nappins since 1988. They are selling the building and need to be out by July. It's unclear if they have enough space in their other facilities to hold the collection from the Galesville building that houses thousands of more phones, including scores that are part of a multi-room museum. Ron Nappin says, at first it looked like it was going to be easy, but as the months go by and the older you get, the harder and harder it gets. Amen, Ron. It was a very wonderful building to operate in, but we're unable to have the resources now financially to operate out of that building. In addition to the phones, some of which are priced at more than $350, there are boxes of handsets, cords, plugs, bells, and wire. They have the 1977 Yellow Pages from Chicago, in case you need that. What's lacking? Customers. Had a succession plan. There are a few orders, and the couple's three children have absolutely no interest in the business. Right now, the other situation is pretty, the order situation, rather, is pretty stagnant, says Ron. The sales are so pitiful. It's in a very sad point of decline. Ron began reading Popular Mechanics while in high school in Illinois, and in the back of the magazine were ads for a company that sold old phones. After serving the U.S. Navy during the Korean War, Ron used the GI Bill in 1957 to attend UW Stout, where he studied education, drove a Model A coupe, and became an industrial arts instructor. He and Mary married in 1960 after they met at a dance and spent 4 years teaching in Amboy, Illinois, 1 year in Mineral Point, and 7 years in Melrose. Didn't really need to know all of that, but fact is, these guys have so many phones. We have so many listeners who are into phones. We are so into phones as well. We should be able to help these folks out, don't you think?
Yes.
Anyone?
I would love to see this put into an office or a hotel or just put these things to use. There's so many. And that thing of having an interest in an antique phone, somehow if you show that, people will start realizing and you accumulate them. They just start sticking to you as a sort of gravity just by that small little bit of interest. So that it grew to this extent is amazing. And these things, when they go away, if it doesn't go to a museum or it doesn't get put into a workable business model, it then becomes harder and harder to restore phones for the people that are interested in maintaining collections. So.
And they actually work, too. You can use them. We use them every day.
Yeah, we should have more kits for ATAs and making them work with digital systems, but absolutely, they do work if you have a small telephone network within your facility or in your neighborhood or just hooked up to whatever service you have through your cable modem.
Yeah, you know, but you just plug it in. You know, if you have a landline, and we use it all the time, the phone rings, we pick it up, and before we even get into whatever the phone call is about, the person comments how nice we sound. How the audio quality is simply amazing.
Or they guess what model phone. Oh, you're on the 302.
Uh-huh.
Okay, no, I knew that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Alex.
You know, I could think of something to do with these phones because, you know, I heard that in 2024 in New York there's going to be a hacker conference in the summer. Something called HOPE.
Yes. HOPE XV is coming. We're gonna make more official announcements later in the month, but yes, I believe it's July 12th through 14th. So mark down the date. It's in the latest issue of 2600. But we are going to, we're in the midst of planning that, and that might be a very good opportunity to display some of these.
Well, it would be. It would be not only to display, but also to sell. I guarantee you that every single phone that they would bring to HOPE would probably be sold. I don't think they would leave with it. You know, if they want to give things away, I'm sure people would be very happy to take certain phones away. But I bet it would be a great place to sell a whole bunch of vintage phones.
Well, keep in mind, Ron is 87. He'll probably be 88 by then. I'm not sure he's into traveling to the Big Apple, but maybe, you know, we'll put him up. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, I was looking at this this article from medicine.com that a listener was kind enough to send us. Unfortunately, it's behind a paywall now, but you can see it on Internet Archive. And just these pictures, these aerial shots of these trailers, these dozens of trailers and containers full of phones, and the phones in them, it's amazing. And yeah, it would truly be a crime if this stuff ended up getting thrown away at some point just because nobody's interested in them. There are so many actual uses for them. This fellow's company does supply them to Hollywood productions and things that take place in the past. You need old phones to decorate. But also just the sheer fact of these as a chunk of history. You know, we've only got a few old phones around this tiny New York apartment and don't have room for any more. And, man, do I wish I could just buy a couple of things off of this fellow.
I mean, we are probably going to be not incredibly far from there in a few months.
We do have family in Wisconsin.
But I'm also curious if some of the places that he's taught might be interested in them. The Center for Cybersecurity and Cyber Defense at the University of Wisconsin at Stout. Guys, are you listening? You have this treasure trove 90 minutes away from you. I want to go now to this town in Wisconsin.
Well,
you can.
Next time you're in Wisconsin, drop on by. Say hi to Ron.
Yeah, check it out and take some pictures.
He can be a guest on our show, in fact.
I'm saying I want to go now.
Oh, okay. We can just fire up the car and head over there.
Let's do it. But wouldn't it be cool if we got them on the show?
Yeah, let's get them on the show.
It would be an interesting conversation. And I think really to find out
the stories they could tell.
Yeah, what it's been like, but also what he needs and what would be ideal. Because then you could build kind of a team of interested people that could help organize or sort through things, look at what could be, valuable or should be a part of a production company or, you know, just try to go through and catalog and just even knowing what you have in a collection of that size would like having an index of it. Is probably very hard, and getting a sense of what it all is part of that conversation. So I think ideally you got to talk to him and then find out what kind of organizing and phases of it would take to actually move it to a safer place and other futures.
You can call them right now. The store's open.
You know, if we talk to them on the air, we could guess what phone they're using. You know, he could switch. I'll bet we'd have lots of fun going from one phone to another and figuring out which one he's using at the moment.
Yeah, how does he
answer?
Book. Can you imagine a phone ringing and he's like, which one? Like running around.
Wow. It sounds like a Twilight Zone episode. Yeah. But Galesville, Wisconsin. So if anybody's near there, there's a lot of phones in the area that you should be interested in, and they will last forever. I've been asked to help promote the radio station and raise some funds, but I can't really be bothered to put that together myself. So I asked our friend Bard to throw something together. Bard?
Greetings, listeners and friends of WBAI-FM, the free radio of New York City. I'm your host, Bard the Hacker, and I'm here to remind you about the importance of supporting non-commercial radio stations like WBAI.
You're not the host.
In a world saturated with commercial media, WBAI stands as a beacon of independent, unfiltered voices. We're not here to sell you products or push a particular agenda. Our mission is to inform, entertain, and challenge you with a diverse range of perspectives on the issues that matter to you. We're proud of our long history of bringing you the voices of the unheard and the voices of dissent. We're the station that gave a platform to the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, and countless other progressive causes. And we're still here, fighting the good fight. We're still bringing you the news that the corporate media doesn't want you to hear. We're still giving a voice to the marginalized and the oppressed. But we can't do it without your support. WBAI is a listener-supported station, which means we rely on your donations to keep our doors open. Every dollar you contribute helps us to continue our mission of providing a free and independent voice for the people of New York City. So please, take a moment to call our pledge line at 212-209-2950 or visit our website at linktogive2dubai.org. Your contribution, no matter how large or small, will help us to continue to be the voice of the voiceless in New York City. Thank you for your support.
Okay, let me just step in. That was a disaster with the website there. The website is give2wbai.org. That's give, the number 2, wbai.org. I don't know what he was trying to say there, but everything else, boy, I think he did a pretty good job. What do you guys think?
Telling us to go to Dubai? Was that what he said?
No, he was...
I heard go to Dubai?
He said link in there at some point, but he was trying to pronounce give and the number 2 and WBAI all at once. I don't know what he was thinking, if anything. But most of it, though, he got what the station is about, and I was impressed. And all I asked was if he could play the part of a radio host for WBAI in New York City, encourage people to support the station. I gave him the phone number, I gave him the website, and I asked, explain why it's important to support non-commercial radio in general and WBAI in particular. And I think he did that. So thank you, Bart. Thank you very much. Wouldn't help to say you're welcome, but I guess I can't get that to happen. All right, we have this bit of news which has been spreading all over the place. And if you look into it, you see that this has been all over the place for months. It's been reported on radio stations. It's been reported on TV news. It's been reported in newspapers. It's all about the 10 most hacked passwords in Louisiana. And every time the story gets reported, it's reported in a different way. Like, this security expert says this, or we uncovered this particular expose. In this particular version, which dates back in June, and the only reason I'm reading this one is because the story I read that came out yesterday referenced this story, 50% of the most common passwords in the U.S. are also among the most hacked passwords, according to safetydetectives.com. You know what? I didn't click on that one. Oh, okay. So the story goes back even further. If I click on that, I'm sure that references something else. But that cybersecurity firm analyzed more than 18 million passwords worldwide for its report on the most used and hacked passwords. I'm not sure how they find out what the most used passwords are if they're not hacked. But here they are, the top 10 most hacked passwords. And I'm not sure why this is for Louisiana, because there's no reference made to Louisiana in here anywhere. Number 10, the common password is I love you, no punctuation. 9123456790. Yes, Alex, so that password is not number 1. You're going to have to say your password is now number 9. I'm sorry. Number 8, 123123. Yes, that's mine, 123123. Mm-hmm. 7, 111111. I'm sensing a numerical theme here. Number 6, 654321. Boy, you know, we're all idiots. We really are. This is the outlier here. Number 5, QWERTY. QWERTY. Basically somebody just running their finger along the keyboard. Number 4.
Depending on the keyboard.
Well, yeah, a QWERTY keyboard. Number 4 is 123456 7. Aha, yeah, we stopped. So it doesn't go all the way to 0. Number 3, 123456 7 8. And number 2 is, of course, password. And the number 1 most hacked password is 123456. Yeah.
It's the same password I have on my luggage.
Now, keep in mind, again, these are the 10 most hacked passwords. So these are the ones that were discovered because people use these very common passwords and got compromised. So doesn't tell you what the 10 most popular passwords are, because maybe they're not hacked as much.
It's weird there weren't any default passwords in there.
Yeah, I'm sure they're in the top 20.
Okay.
Okay, well, we only have a couple of minutes left before we have to go, but this story I thought was kind of interesting. Federal judge on Tuesday, it might have been last Tuesday, actually, refused to bring back a class action lawsuit alleging 4 auto manufacturers had violated Washington state's privacy laws by using vehicles' onboard infotainment systems to record and intercept customers' private text messages and mobile phone call logs. Okay, that is something. Plaintiffs in one of the 5 cases filed suit against Honda in 2021, arguing that beginning in at least 2014, infotainment systems in the company's vehicles began downloading and storing a copy of all text messages on smartphones when they were connected to the system. All text messages on smartphones, not just the ones that they were sending at the time, apparently. An Annapolis, Maryland-based company, Birla Corporation, provides the technology to some car manufacturers but does not offer it to the general public, the lawsuit said. Once messages are downloaded, Birla's software makes it impossible for vehicle owners to access their communications and call logs, but does provide law enforcement with access. Alex, any thoughts on this? This is incredible.
Yeah, that's fairly horrendous, if in fact those allegations are true. Emmanuel, did you say that the case was tossed out and a judge refused to revive it? Is that what happened here?
Basically, I'm not sure what Tuesday this was, but the federal judge refused to bring back a class action lawsuit. So the lawsuit apparently has been dismissed, and the judge refused to bring it back.
So that's actually bad.
Yeah. That's
really bad. And I think these vehicles are exceedingly becoming infinitely trackable and sort of edge filtering devices for all of your traffic.
Well, it's just incredible that they suck all the messages out of your phone and won't let you access them, but they will hand them over to law enforcement.
Well, of course they will, right? Because they have to hand them over to law enforcement if they have them, and they receive a subpoena or law enforcement obtains a warrant on probable cause, then they really don't have a choice but to hand it over. The simple fact of the matter is they shouldn't have had it in the first place. You know, it's in a sense you could claim that, well, maybe it's our fault because nobody's reading the fine print when you connect to these devices or understand how they use our personal data or even collect our personal data. But it's impossible to do that. We know that. It really shouldn't be beholden on the user to read through a three-hour-long privacy statement about the collection and use of their personal data. We need to make sure that that type of collection activity is front and center for the user to either consent to it or to say, absolutely not, you cannot download my text messages. And I guarantee you, if you read that privacy policy, you would have no idea that it was going to hoover up your actual text messages anyhow.
Why would a car company do this to its customers? I can't fathom that.
Well, they want the data so that they can mine it, package it up with other data, perhaps perform some analysis on it, and then try to sell that data to third parties or sell you something else in the future.
Yeah, but you know what they're not going to sell? They're not going to sell cars. They're not going to sell cars to those people ever again.
That's right. That's quite possibly the case.
Oh, give me a nice vintage car with a jammer in it. I'm good.
Yeah, yeah. Good argument for that. Hey, look at that. We're out of time already, but we'll be on YouTube at 8 o'clock with an experiment, so join us there, oth@2600.com. We'll see you next week. Good night.
There's no song for the singer, no words for the tune. There's a mess in the message and a man on the moon. There's no plan in the planet, so gone berserk. There's a milk bottle shortage and the traffic lights don't work. Lie down and count it, don't take any more. Lie down. But there's hope for the couple who stroll in the park. There's nuclear power to light up the dark. There's national health and ice in the fridge. The occasional cow on a motorway bridge. You. There's a mess.
him the message.